Welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. As the creator and host of this podcast, it is critical to me to convey to you, our listeners, how much positive power you have inside of you right now, in this very moment. You have the power to change your life. And that could be changing it, like I had to back when I was 23, from a place of kind of being on a road to nowhere, kind of feeling hopeless and stuck, to being on a road to somewhere desirable, someplace good. It could also be changing your life from good to great. And it could also be changing your life from great to, I cannot believe how incredibly blessed and lucky I am to get to live this life. You have that power inside of you, and that is all you need to get started. The rest, you can learn along the way. I started this podcast as a way to bring stories of hope and triumph, as well as resources that will help you along that journey, whatever that might be, whatever your starting place is, or whatever your destination might be. My sincerest hope is that you find it valuable. So let's go. Here is this week's episode. Before diving into this week's episode, I just want to pause and say thank you, because I don't know if you know it or not, but this is our episode number 100, which is a huge milestone in podcasting. I heard once that most podcasts don't make it past episode 13. So we are well on our way, and I just wanted to pause to thank everyone who's been on our show before, and to all of you who have listened, who have shared it, and who have subscribed and followed us. So thank you in helping us make episode 100 a reality. Here's to the next 100. Today we have a returning guest. You may remember him. His name is Stephen Shedletsky. Stephen, or Shed as his friends call him, helps people listen to and nurture the voice of others. He supports humble leaders, those who know that they are both part of the problems they experience and the solutions they can create, and who put their people and their purpose first. Feeling stifled on his corporate track, Shed was introduced to Simon Sinek's work and was immediately inspired by it. He met Simon in 2010 and soon after joined as the fourth member of his team. Stephen began by answering fan email and soon became the first person outside of Simon to lead his social media efforts. He moved on to hold the roles of chief of staff and head of brand experience, training, and development. Leading a global team of speakers and facilitators at Simon Sinek Inc., Stephen worked to ensure the team's culture, products, and communications authentically reflected the organization's most deeply held values and beliefs. He also narrated the audiobook for Simon Sinek's book, Find Your Why, a practical guide for discovering purpose for you and your team. Though Stephen still works to share Simon's message, helping to build a more inspired, safe, and fulfilled world, he also works to advance his own ideas on leadership, speak-up culture, and psychological safety through speaking, writing, coaching, and advising. He has led hundreds of keynote presentations, workshops, and leadership development programs. Shed works with leaders and organizations around the world and serves clients in any industry where human beings work. He graduated from the Richard Ivey School of Business with a focus on leadership, communication, and strategy, and he received his coaching certification from the Coactive Training Institute. He lives in Toronto with his wife and two young kids. And as you're going to hear, we're mixing things up just a little bit today because we both have similar backstories and we're sharing experiences around those. Stephen.
Yes.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I was saying to you, Bobby, the first time just before we hit record, this is the first time I've been invited back to a podcast. So I think it's the first time. So I'm not sure what that says about my other podcast interviews, but we had our first conversation. We centered it around leadership and cultures and speak up cultures, yeah, which was a blast. And toward the end of that first show, I said, I'm pretty sure I made the point that I'm a big believer that what we've overcome as kids and young adults very much informs our strengths as adults.
Yep.
And I know because I did my research before our first podcast and reading your bio and just doing a bit of a read up on you, that you have overcome a speech impediment. Same with me. I always say overcoming because it's never overcome. It's always overcoming. And so we sort of agreed at the end of our first show, hey, let's do another talking about our shared experiences, overcoming our speech impediments and fear of public speaking for, and certainly for me.
Oh man.
So that's to switch up roles. I figured I'd do the, I did the opening intro here, at least to set the table. But yeah, any further thoughts from you before we dive in and interview one another?
I know. Our experiences? I'm excited about this. And I loved it when you said, and it was near the interview, the end of that first interview, when you said something like that's it, you know, whatever you said really triggered that in terms of it does affect us and it affects how we want to show up and how we want to help others. And so I loved it. I loved this whole notion. So, and by the way, thank you for coming back and being so generous with your time. I appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, maybe I can hop in and share a little bit, you know, and hear from you, like sort of your experience, and then just ask each other questions. And hopefully, I mean, you don't need listeners out there. You don't need to have a speech impediment to have something that you've overcome in your life and to use that as a gateway into your purpose, quite frankly.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, Bobby, I've made a career and my passion is in helping others nurture the voice of other people, themselves and others. I'm a really big, I love helping people express their feelings and ideas in a way that they are heard, and to help them help others express their ideas and feelings in a way that they are heard. That just means healthier, better relationships, better humanity from my perspective. For me, I come from a long line of stutterers because it is genetic. I married a speech pathologist, a speech therapist, good choice, not just for me, but for my kids. And yeah, my dad, my uncle, my grandfather, all on my dad's side, have stutters, you know, have all had successful, good lives, but communicating and public speaking has been a challenge. Ironically, my dad is a great public speaker. He writes wonderful speeches. And still, I mean, there are times when I hear it that he stutters. I think one of the things that's interesting about stutterers is we hear it so much more than others hear it. But yeah, sort of just sort of high level, my story is I realized I had a problem when I was in about grade 2. And what's interesting now with my wife as a speech therapist, she's a big believer in early intervention. That if you can get to kids before they're aware that they have an impediment, you can actually do a lot of work with it quite quick and quite young. And so I figured it out by the time I was in about grade 2 that I had a challenge. I went to a speech therapist that for some reason, they gave me a clicker to count the number of times that I stuttered in a day, which is the wrong approach.
Yeah,
because it reinforces the negative behavior.
Yeah, that's bizarre. And so
I think the thought was be aware of my stuttering so that I would slow down my speech and like work through it. But I mean, I walked out. I remember I walked out at, you know, 10:15 in the morning recess with a clicker in my hand. And one of my friends or another kid out in the yard is like, what is that? And I'm like, it's a clicker. Why do you use it? I just put it in my pocket and I never use it again.
No.
So that didn't work. And then I remember a few years later, I just kind of went by, but I was the kid that like I had personality and I was jovial, but only when I felt comfortable. And I would, you know, rarely raise my hand in class. I was quite quiet and lacked confidence. And then in grade 6, I was in French class. I'm Canadian, so French is in our elementary system. And it was my turn to read French in front of the entire class. You're like snaking through the class. And you know, when I remember I was sitting, I think I was the second or third in from the end of the row. And as it was sneaking in front of me, I could hear and feel my heart beating in my like ears and chest. And then, you know, the voices came closer and closer as it was my turn. And I'm reading in now a language that isn't my mother tongue. So even more nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
And I started to read and it was going okay. And I could very much, you know, like hear my voice in my ears. Like I was very conscious that I was like listening to myself reading and speaking. It's very weird. And then I got to the word très, which I can say now. Très is like the third word you learn in French. Très bien means very.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say the word because it's a harsh beginning. TR, très, like it's a hard word. And so I was stuck on it. And the harder that I tried to say it, it was like a finger trap. Like the harder you try to pull it out, the harder it is to get it out. And I remember I couldn't say it. My French teacher, who I remember very well, said, Stephen, what's the matter? I tried to pull it, like push it out once more, couldn't come. And then I finally relented and said, I can't pronounce the word. And she said, you can't pronounce très next. And she skipped me.
No.
And it was the most deflating, embarrassing, you know, confidence hitting moment of one of the top of my life. I have, you know, knock on wood, many more years of life to go. So there might be more embarrassing.
There might be.
Yeah. But I remember just feeling so deflated. And I went home and I said to my mom, I need help.
Yeah.
I can't go on like this. I just knew that this would limit me being able to be confident and have a life or a career. And so that summer, I went to an organization that's still around today, founded by a great speech pathologist who unfortunately just passed away, Bob Kroll, called the Speech and Stuttering Institute. And I went to like a summer camp. It was an intensive sort of 6-week program. I was the youngest person. I was 13 at the time. There was one other person who was 14. And then everyone else, I think it was mostly men because stuttering impacts men more than women genetically. I think there was one or two females in the class, but I remember there was once one person who was Sri Lankan who could say his first name, which was George, but he couldn't pronounce his own last name.
Wow.
And I remember they coached him through each syllable. And by the end of it, he could pronounce his own last name. There's another gentleman, you know, well-educated, couldn't land a job because he couldn't perform in an interview. And so a couple things happened. I mean, one, I was 13 years old. I started taking the subway in the morning to get to this thing. So just like a growing up experience in the big city. And then the other thing that happened was I realized that my stutter wasn't as bad as other people who were older than me. And it was a confidence boost. It gave me some tips and tricks, a great community to work on it with. And then here was the kicker. And then I want to hear your story. But the kicker for me was it was really the first time in my life that I learned service and the power of service. Because I created a really nice relationship, particularly with this, you know, mid-20-year-old gentleman who was smart, well-educated, but couldn't land a job. And we became friends. I'm pretty sure I was half of his age, but he was like my big brother and we developed this nice relationship. And quite frankly, I had a bit more confidence than he did. And so I began to actually coach him and help him and share things that were working with me. And I realized, you know, I do a lot of work with my colleagues, Simon Sinek, and Simon, you know, describes that, you know, we have a section in the bookstore called self-help. And the irony about self-help is it doesn't work. We're not designed to only worry about us. We're designed to help others.
Yeah.
And that, you know, indeed, if the self-help industry actually worked, someone would write a book, you know, 7 steps to, and it would actually work. And then the industry would stop growing. But the only thing the self-help industry helps is itself. And so really the industry we should have is the help others industry. Because if you want to overcome your fear, help another. And in you helping another, you'll learn and experience yourself as well. That's why we have AA in Alcoholics Anonymous. AA knows that if you do steps 1 through 11, you're not going to beat the disease and you never beat it. You're always beating. And step 12 is service, is to take what you know and share it and give it to another. And that's what helps you continue to beat that disease. So that's a long way for me just to say, and then I want to hear your story. I learned the value of helping others through going through this experience of trying to overcome my own speech impediment and fear of public speaking.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities there in our stories.
Do tell.
Yeah. Well, first of all, so when you went to, I have a question for you. When you went to your mom and you said, hey, I see this limit and I need to do something about it. Was she, it sounds like she was supportive.
Yes. She was very supportive.
That's cool.
Yeah. She was very supportive.
Yeah. So when you saw the limit, because that's one of the things too, like I knew that I had, it wasn't a surprise, and, you know, that this was going to be a limitation for me. I think that sometimes when we see a limit, we can also run from it, hide from it. Sure. You confronted it. What do you think was behind that?
It's a great question. I don't know. I think it was a couple of things. I think one, I knew that speaking was a thing that I had to do. I didn't want to be mute and I didn't live in a world where that was rewarded. And so I think I just kind of knew, well, I'm not going to speak. And so I might as well get help to do it better. And then I think, you know, fortunately coming from a very supportive, loving family really helped.
Yeah.
And that I had this issue. I had good relationships with my mom and my dad, you know, youngest of three with two older siblings. And yeah, I knew that I wouldn't be mocked. I would be supported. And so, I mean, I was teased, you know, but yeah, I think it's because I knew that, I knew it was getting in the way. It was going to continue to get in the way. And I was ready to work on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you too. Cause it's,
thanks.
It's one of those, it's not easy. It's really not, you know, and what surprises me too is, I mean, I've told my speech, the story of my speech problems many times, like when I've done keynotes and that type of things. It is stunning to me how many people come up afterwards and they say either they had something similar, whether it's a learning disability, speech problem, whatever it might be, but something like that. It's either them or their kids. I mean, it's very, very common that we face these things. So yeah, mine started, I mean, I didn't even try to start talking until I was four.
Wow.
I was just one of those. I was a quiet kid. I liked to listen. I was always interested in listening to what other people were saying. So by the time I started, I mean, I was making some sounds, you know, like, and I was saying a few things, but I wasn't really trying to even talk, I don't think. So when I was six, I went to a tiny school in rural Illinois, like tiny. And they brought in a speech pathologist because they're like, yeah, Bobby has a problem here with speaking. And it didn't go well. It was terrible. It was absolutely awful. And he told my mom after the evaluation, he said, well, you know, it's hopeless. She's destined to have a lifelong disability because of this. And my
What was terrible about the experience?
Oh, going through the, I remember there was a test, Stephen, where it was, he recited a line from the Star Spangled Banner and I was supposed to repeat it back to him. I didn't have to sing it. Thank goodness. All I had to do was say it back to him. But there were like 17 sounds I couldn't make. And I stuttered on top of it. And the stutter, of course, got worse when you're nervous. And I was really nervous. And like, I had a really hard time with S's, T's, R's, G's, L's, D. I mean, the word milk, forget it. Couldn't say that word to save my life. And so I knew it was going bad and I could feel his judgment. You know what I mean? I could feel his judgment and that made it worse.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget when my mom told him that, like, oh, you know, she's never going to talk correctly, whatever. You know, she told me what he had to say, but then she hugged me. And I think she changed my life in this moment because she pulled me into a really big hug and she whispered in my ear, she said, we're not going to listen to him because you never let someone else tell you what you can or cannot do. And I'll tell you, when you think about growth mindset, that's one of my signature things. Because I remember like with the word milk, for example, I remember trying to say it. And one day I said to mom, I'm like, I can't say it. And she stopped me and she said, you can't say it yet. What a powerful word. It's a simple little word, but my God, is that a powerful word?
Yeah.
And I kept trying, you know, and we kept working on it. And I remember one day I was probably in the second or third grade. Her friend Millie was over and they were having coffee. And this was back in the early 70s, right? And I was trying to ask my mom something. I have no idea what I was trying to ask her. And she knew what I was trying to ask her, but that was because she was my mom. And mom kept working. And she's like, nope, you know, she was trying to help me with it. And Millie said, Kathy, that's my mom's name. Millie said, do you know what she's asking you? And mom said, yes, I do. And Millie's like, well, then why don't you just give it to her, whatever. And mom looked at Millie and she said, do you know what she's trying to ask? And Millie said, I have no idea. And my mom said, that's the problem. The whole world isn't going to work as hard as I am to understand her. And I thought, that's, I don't know, powerful. Because it made me realize that, yeah, like, I have to do the work here.
Yeah.
You know? And then, oh God, when I was in the fourth grade, did your school have the holiday plays that every grade had to put on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. So I was in the fourth grade. Up until then, I got to be an angel. I got to be a dancer. You know, my fourth grade year, my teacher said to me, I had to find a way for you to be in this thing, but you cannot open your mouth. So when you said the whole thing about feeling like you're mute.
Yeah.
Oh boy. And I realized, oh, it's terrible. In the sixth grade in our holiday play, They put a chair in the middle of the stage. And for the play, I stood on the chair the entire time. I didn't have a costume. I didn't do anything. I stood there on the chair. And I thought, I am a prop.
Mm.
And I'm like, I can do better than this. I don't know how I can do better than this, but I can do better than this. You know, so that was always, those experiences really planted that seed. And then when I was in the eighth grade, I decided this is a problem. I mean, this is, because like you, like those days when you had to read out loud in class, like I'm counting 12 people ahead, trying to figure out what's my, I didn't hear anything anybody else read.
And then where's recess and like doing the math to see like, am I going to hit recess before it's my turn to speak?
And maybe they'll forget about me. Or yeah. Worse than that, there's always that one kid who reads two paragraphs, you know, and it throws off my math.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh, and which one you're going to read. Yeah. Yeah. Turning so ahead. Like,
oh, I hated that. So I thought, okay, I have to do something about this. So I decided I'm going to take a speech class in high school. And so I took, and I was petrified. I'll never forget the day of the first class, the first speech. It was on muscular dystrophy because you're supposed to pick something you were passionate about, which was great because I was passionate about it. But there's a lot of big words that you have to say. Bad decision on my part. But the speech teacher was Mr. Jordan, and he happened to be the coach for the speech and debate team. And so I gave my first speech. And I'm not being hard on myself when I say this. It was a train wreck. I practiced it at home and it was 8 minutes like it was supposed to be. I think I delivered it in 5 minutes and 27 seconds because I just rushed through it as fast as I could. I knew it was bad, but I finished and I sat down. I'm like, oh my God, that was terrible. And when the bell rang to dismiss class, Mr. Jordan said, hey, Bobby, can you stick around for a minute? And I thought, oh my God, I've done so bad. He's going to tell me not to come back. But instead, he said, have you ever thought about joining the speech and debate team?
Wow.
And I remember looking at him, Stephen, and I said, did you hear me speak? Like, you must have me confused with somebody else. And he's like, no. He said, you've got potential. And he said, I can work with you and I can help you. And he said, with your work ethic and the potential you have, we can make this happen.
And that is leadership.
That's leadership. And that is why I do what I do to this day. Because I decided, I mean, it took me a while because I'm like, I'm going to fail at this horribly. And I did for a while, but I eventually won tournaments. But I'm like, that's the power when you come alongside of someone and you say, I can help you because you have potential. And I think that's one of the reasons I believe so much in the fact that I don't care what our present performance is. That's just our present performance. That does not determine what our potential is or what we can do in the future.
Yeah.
So that's definitely how it affected me.
So there's a standard in the US Marines that to be able to lead another, you have to have affection toward the person in your in your span of care, which I love. And the way I would define affection is that you see genius, worth, and potential in another. Like you can find a strength in them. If you view that somebody on your team is rubbish, I have news for you. You aren't fit to lead them.
That's right.
Which means they still could fit in the organization under somebody else's leadership.
That's right. That's right.
Or not.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they don't fit. Like, that's okay.
That's okay too. Yeah. You said affection was genius, worth. And when you see genius, worth, and potential.
Yeah. That you can see they have a strength. I can help develop and nurture that in them. That is the standard of leadership, which I love.
Yeah. That was powerful. Think about how that changed my life.
Yeah. Have you, I have a few comments on the stories you shared, but Do you have a story of what, remind me his name, that
Mr. teacher? Jordan.
Mr. Jordan.
Yeah.
Have you Mr. Jordan somebody else?
Oh, yeah. Lots of times.
Yeah.
Because that's just what feeds me.
Yeah.
Mr. Jordan. I love that you turn that into a verb.
It's a verb. but this is when we help people identify and articulate their purpose, It's this, which is, you know, one of the ways is to, there are many, you know, our purpose is our origin story. It's who we are, and Who we are comes from our past.
Yeah.
And so to help someone discover and articulate, because, you know, first it's like, oh, there's this thing called purpose and I have one, and then put it into words, because when you can put it into words, it's a lot easier to live it and to share it with others.
Yeah.
But it's these Mr. Jordan moments. It's these moments in our lives when someone went out of their way to help us. And then us doing what Mr. Jordan did to you to others is what, right? That's your fuel.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's so cool.
What's really interesting there too, Stephen, when you said, when you defined affection.
Yeah.
Especially when I was doing, because I've taught a lot of programs in person. And it comes across on Zoom as well, like when you're doing the remote. But I got the feedback even more when it was in person. People would come up to me at a break and they'd say, I really feel like you care about me. And I'm like, oh, of course I do. But it's not, I don't stand up there and say, hey, I really care about you. Like that, those words never, they don't come out of my mouth.
No.
But this, I mean, it's happened thousands of times for me. And that just connected a dot, because it's, when I'm teaching, when I'm facilitating, I just see potential.
Yeah.
I that's all I see.
Yeah. Well, it's great. I love that. I mean, there are certain things that we shouldn't describe of ourselves.
Tell me more.
Well, so we cannot, we can describe them of ourselves, but it is simply more powerful when others describe it. Mm. So it means more to your reputation if I say Bobby is very caring, as opposed to you going, I'm a really caring person, which is like run away. Right?
When someone says, I'm very honest. Why do you have to tell me that?
Yeah. Just prove it. Show it. Yeah.
I should know that.
Yeah. I've heard people describe themselves as empathetic. I've heard people describe themselves as really great listeners. Even to go, I'm funny. Like, no, like you're not allowed to say those things. Do people laugh at your jokes? Now you're funny. Do people tell you, when I'm with you, I feel that you are present and that you really hear what I'm saying? Now you're a good listener.
Right.
So there are certain things that mean more when others describe us that way than if we describe ourselves that way. You can say, it makes me very proud when, and I strive to be.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. That's what other people. Yeah.
Yeah. So you, just a couple of things. So I have two young kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. And one of the things that I kind of revel in is when my kids, you know, I think unfortunately we have parents now that we bubble wrap our kids and expect them to become independent, integrated adults. Doesn't work that way. And it's kind of, you know, one of the things that my daughter unfortunately inherited from me is that she likes doing things that she's very good at, and she doesn't like doing things that she's not very good at. And so we've tried to, like, this is where resilience comes from.
Yeah.
Is resilience comes from knowing that you can do hard things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why that I'm a believer in, I mean, I come from a lineage of having grandparents who are Holocaust survivors. And I can't imagine going through what they had to go through, but they've had these amazing lives and they're absolutely amazing people who have been able to just deal with what is in front of them, get on with it and keep going. And so the unscathed life creates not a lot of resilience.
Yeah.
So, you know, personally, I feel fortunate that I've been through what I've been through.
I do too.
If it weren't for it, I wouldn't be who I am. Mm-mm. And it's the experience with Millie, that story that you shared of your mom, you know, the standard was, we have a guest in our home and our guest should be able to understand what you're asking for. You know, I'm also teaching particularly my eldest to snow ski right now. And it's, if she can only snow ski with me around, you know, without, like, she needs to be able to ski independently.
That's right.
If she wants to become a skier.
That's right.
Otherwise, I have to do everything with and for her. So, you know, we purposely put her in lessons so that what it wasn't with me. And quite frankly, she'd have someone who would have a bit more patience than her dad. But it reminded me of, until my daughter can ski with another, she is a skier. As opposed, mm-hmm. like it's a nice standard with that your mom did with Millie, which I thought is,
yeah,
it wasn't torture. It was development.
That's right. And yeah. She wasn't trying to bubble wrap me to use your
right.
word picture.
Because then it would true. Just to give you milk.
That's but right.
Yeah.
Because no one else would know.
Right.
But I always, even at the time, but a lot more now than at the time, but I always appreciated it because I knew it was coming from a good place.
It was love and support. Though,
it was love and support.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have one more story here. I have two like pivotal more moments from my experience of overcoming.
Okay.
That I think I hope will be helpful because unfortunately, one of, if not the only way to overcome a fear is to face it.
That's right.
Whether it's on purpose or not. So the summer of grade six, I went to the Speech and Stuttering Institute, the stuttering camp here in Toronto, and huge development. And then it would have been, so two summers later, I was back at summer camp, not the stuttering one, just a different summer camp. And that summer, we each section of the camp does their own play and performance, you know, whether it's Bye Bye Birdie or Moulin Rouge or whatever it was. And don't worry, they're not.
That sounds great. Impressive.
Feel free to lower your standards. Some of them are okay. But I was in the section that year where we did like the Saturday Night Live version, which is a lot of fun. It was like improv and sketch comedy where mm-hmm. we would, you know, with the staff in the section, we would create these skits that were funny and that either had that were either just plain funny or kind of poked fun at something that happened that summer, you know?
Yeah.
I remember I was in one scene instead of singing in the rain, it was pooping in Boy's Mane. As the boy's main wash house. So I remember one of the characters that I was supposed to play, as you can imagine, there aren't many people in the world with my last name, Shedletsky.
No.
But there was one other family at the summer camp whose last name was Shedletsky, and there's no relation.
Are you kidding me?
No relation. So they spell theirs S-K-Y, we spell ours Z-K-Y. But it's meaningless because when we came over from Poland to Canada, they just anglicized it. But we figured out that if you go enough generations back, we were both from this same town called Shedletz.
Wow.
So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So I remember that one of my characters was playing the role of a different Shedletsky. And so I had a fairly prominent role in this play. And they asked me and I think three other of the campers in the play to go to the dining hall and to do a little commercial or promo. It was like a live commercial for the camp to come to the theater that evening, even though they had no other choice. And I was in character playing this person who also had my same last name. And my last name is not an easy one to pronounce. In fact, people ask me how to pronounce it. And I say, I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out myself. It's actually quite phonetical. But
it
I remember
is.
That I got really nervous and that I was stuttering over my own last name, just
no.
like my Sri Lankan friend George couldn't say his own last name. And I remember practicing it with one of the staff members. Her name was Lauren. And she was like, what's wrong with you? Like, what's going on? And I was nervous and I was stuttering over my own last name. And finally, even though I couldn't say my own last name, it was time to go do this commercial. And we went out and I stuttered over my own last name. I said like Shedletsky. And it came out, but I remember it was kind of this like amazing liberating experience because I had done the very thing that I was so afraid of doing and nothing happened.
Right.
I didn't die. You know, no one sort of, what's that character from The Simpsons Nelson, who points his finger and just goes, ha ha. Like, none That's of that right. happened. None of that happened. And either nobody noticed or nobody cared. And like, that was it. And I was kind of like, this is amazing. Like, I can fail. And it was fine.
You still lived.
I still lived. And I don't think anybody noticed or anybody cared.
No.
And then, you know, 2 hours later, the lights were on and we were doing the play and I had a blast and had a pretty prominent role. And it was like amazing and an amazing feeling.
Yeah.
So it was one of the, and I wanted to share it also from the perspective that anyone who's listening and has a fear, if you wish to overcome it, you have to face it and you have to put yourself in experiences that help you get and move through it if you truly want to.
I love that. And it's so true, no matter what the fear is. Like I love cross country skiing. We live 2 minutes from the Nordic Center. I will be going out later today for day 29, but there's a run there called Roller Coaster and it's a Black Expert one. And it lives up to its name. It's twisty. It's up and down. And there's this one point you're standing at the top and you're like, oh my God, this is scary. Cause you're going to go down and you got a sharp turn. First time I fell was the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. It's like the worst thing that I thought could happen just happened. And I'm getting up and I'm skiing again. I actually skied right back up it so I could go down it again. But that's the thing. I think a lot of times we think, well, in order to face a fear, we have to, you know, we have to do it perfectly, right? We have to, like, I have to ski that run perfectly. No, it doesn't matter how you ski it. It matters that you ski it. You know, in your case, it was that you tried. I mean, that's my take on it. What are your thoughts?
Oh, for sure. For sure. The other thing you're making me think of. So my coach also shared with me in my last session I did with him, the difference between skiing and surfing is that, with skiing, the mountain doesn't move.
It doesn't move. It's hard though, when you fall.
Of course.
but it doesn't move.
But it doesn't move. And which is interesting because you did it the first time and you're like, okay, now I know how to do it, and did it again.
That's right.
Which is interesting, but it also points to the difference between technical and adaptive performance.
Yes.
So the first time you did the hill, it was adaptive because you had never done it before. And you went, okay, you figured it out, you fell. And your body and mind learned, oh, here's how I can do it next time not to fall.
Yeah.
You're right. And I'm sure you didn't fall the second time.
No.
And now it becomes technical.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. The difference, and I've heard of it, you know, the adaptive and technical challenges. Can you speak just a little bit more about the difference in those, just for the listeners?
So this is work. It's Ronald Heifetz does this out of Harvard. Also, there's a book, Primed to Perform, by Neil Doshi and Lindsay McGregor. They speak about this as well. So the difference between technical and adaptive is technical is you apply known skills and known experiences to a known problem.
Right.
Which means you can also scale and repeat. Adaptive is when you have no prior experience, knowledge, or skills. It's new. Mm-hmm. So my coach shared it to me in the context of, this is my first global pandemic. am I first global pandemic being a father of two young kids and having a career and having, you know, a partner who works as well and, you know, dealing with all the stuff that we've never navigated through before, you know, how to navigate COVID in our house and all this stuff.
Right.
And so he pointed out to me that, you know, it's kind of, I've never surfed. I might try it soon. Actually, I'm going to San Diego, all things, if it all happens in a month. And I'm going with a friend who's like, we're going to try surfing. And I went,
nice. Okay.
But I'm assuming that no two waves are the exact same. And so, I mean, even if you ski, you know, no two ski days condition wise are the same.
Is different.
Yeah. But if you go down the same hill, you kind of know what to expect when you keep doing it and keep doing it. So
at least you know where the turns are.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and that helps. That helps a lot.
So, but yeah, just this point that adaptive is where you have to actually do divergent thinking and innovate and figure it out as you go.
Yeah. When I was taking a, a ski lesson. And we're lucky because one of our Nordic centers here, we have a 6-time Olympian who's running it. Not that I've taken lessons from him yet, but that's on the list. Yeah, there we go. But one of the things that someone told me when I took a lesson or I was talking to someone is they said, when you're trying something new like that, a new hill or whatever it might be, you need to try it at least 3 times. The first time is to prove to yourself that you can survive.
Yep.
The second time is to kind of, but it's true, right? The second time is to kind of normal.
If you don't make it past the first time, you probably shouldn't have tried that hill, but hey.
And then you got nothing to worry about. Yeah. You know? But the second time is to kind of normalize it and to prove it wasn't a fluke.
Yeah.
The third time is when you can start actually to say, huh, do I even like this? Because the first 2 times you might not like it at all. Like roller coaster, the first few times I did it, I was terrified. And then after the third or fourth time, I'm like, oh, that's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. You know? But I thought that was really good advice because sometimes we try something once and we're like, oh my goodness, it's so uncomfortable. I don't like that. Uncomfortable is not the same as whether or not we like it. You know what I mean?
Oh, nice. Yeah, you're confusing. I mean, it's growth ed.
That's right.
So of course it's going to feel uncomfortable and scary. But if you survive the first, do it a second to prove it wasn't a fluke, do it a third to now see if you like it.
Right.
And does it put you in flow, right? Flow is you're challenged by it, but you're also skilled and you want to get better. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thought that was because cool. Otherwise we confuse that, the discomfort with, I don't like it.
Yeah.
But when you're trying something new, especially when it's an adaptive challenge, it's likely we're not going to feel comfortable.
No. Yeah. It's called growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else here for you just on this experience and for you and any other sort of lessons or stories or.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you were talking at the very beginning, you said something that was really important to you is nurturing the voice of self and others, right? It triggered for me back when I was in undergrad, I took a class on teams. And one of the things, Donna was our professor, Donna Younger, and she had us do the Kolb learning styles for teams. I don't know if you've ever done those. Oh,
yeah. I'm not
David
sure
Kolb, K-O-L-B, genius, known as like the father of adult learning. His stuff is amazing. So we did these things. And I've always found, like when I'm in a team setting, I often am somehow appointed the leader, right? And I like that role. And truthfully, I always thought there's something wrong with me. Maybe I just like, you know, I like being the one out in front, or like maybe I thought it was for some kind of self-centered reason. When I did this assessment, though, what I found is, yes, I like being in that role because I like making sure that other people, that all people, all voices are heard. And that was just, it was illuminating for me to understand why I liked that role. Nice. And it had nothing to do with me, right? It had to do with the fact that, and it's probably because my voice wasn't heard for so many years. I like making sure that all voices are heard. And it's funny because then I did Marcus Buckingham Standout.
Yep.
And that's what my profile came back is, you make sure all voices are heard. It's just, I think when you have those kind of experiences,
yeah,
it just does something. I mean, what about you?
Well, you're making me think, Bobby, it's one of my favorite experiences to do when I'm in a meeting is, I mean, I'm extroverted. It's easier for me to speak up. I tend to do it quite a bit. So for me, it's to work on picking my spots as opposed to making it the default to speak up.
Yeah.
But the other thing I love doing is really noticing the body language of other people, particularly introverts and those who are less willing to lean in and speak up, who oftentimes have the best contribution to make, but they're not making it because there's no space being made for them to lean in and share. So it's one of my favorite things to do, which is, we haven't heard from so-and-so in a while. And my instinct is you're sitting on something worth, you know, good to share. Cause every time you open your mouth, it's good. And it at least creates space, you know, every now and then they'll go, no, I got nothing. And I'm like, okay, well, just know that your voice is always welcome.
That's right.
Or they'll go, oh, thank you. You know, here's this, that, and the other. It's one of my favorite things to do is to call on people who I know the wheels are spinning and turning, but it's just not their default, bust their elbows in and have their voice heard.
No. And those are usually the people that when they speak, everyone else leans in.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what are they saying this time?
Because it's wise. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it requires some relationship. Like, you know, it's something that you have to know. You have to know the people to know if they'll respond well to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of my favorite things to do.
Yeah. I can see that. I can see that completely. Because we've been talking here. I think we could talk the whole day about this. Because it keeps leading to other pieces of the puzzle. Anything that you haven't said yet that you want to make sure you do say before we wrap up?
Well, there was one last experience that came to mind, and maybe it just already proves points that we've made, but I remember I took a public speaking class in college. It was my last year. I was a senior. And I had this amazing professor who's born in New Zealand. So he's a Kiwi. And he ended the first class. It was one of these double classes. So each class was 3 hours. So you'd have 90 minutes of break and 90 minutes. And he ended sort of the first 3 hour session sharing Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And he said, your assignment for next class, should you choose to accept, is to share something with as much passion as Dr. King, which is like, ooh, that's no small order.
That's a big challenge.
And I, you know, I'm Canadian. So there were people who spoke of their love of curling, you know, their favorite hockey team, or there was one person who spoke about mint chocolate chip ice cream. I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, justice and equal rights goes a little bit higher, but okay, you know, passion, if you're really, if that's what floats your float, that's fine. But I remember sitting in that class and I, like, you know, lightning struck, I knew the one thing I had to share, which was sharing with this class of public speakers that I'm terrified of public speaking. Mm-hmm. And that I've learned, you know, at that time, I began to enjoy it. I began mm-hmm. to become good at it. And it was the first time, you know, I remember giving this talk. It was a 5-minute talk. And I spoke about the French class and not being able to say the word très. But it was the first time that I deliberately gave a speech that was for the purpose of service. It was because, you know, there's the Jerry Seinfeld joke, which is proven with data that the number one fear, I think, in North America is public speaking, and number two is death. So you'd rather be the one in the casket than the one giving the eulogy, which makes no sense.
None.
And so, I was in this class there, and I knew that public speaking was a fear, and I sensed and felt it in the class. Mm-hmm. And that there were also people who English wasn't their first language. So there was that added layer of fear as well. And so I remember giving this talk, and I remember like a pin could drop in the class. Like I felt the engagement, and I felt that it was actually, you know, I wasn't speaking to be heard. I was speaking to give. I was speaking, attempting to help move a room for the better. And I'm sure I didn't move everyone for the better, but I know I moved a few, and evidence is the fact that I made friends in that class that I've kept in touch with, who still talk about that little 5-minute speech I gave, and that it helped them. And so I mention it because I became hooked to that feeling, and I wanted to keep doing it, not for me, but to try to use my voice and speaking for the betterment of others.
Yeah.
So I just share it because this is what it means to feel fulfilled. Fulfillment is using our talents, our gifts, our strengths, and contribute to something bigger than ourselves, bigger than our own life that we care about. And if enough of us do that in our day-to-day, we will live a fulfilled life. We will do a better job of reaching, surpassing, realizing that infinite potential. Because we're not born with a bucket that says, you know, Bobby, here's your potential. Get to the top of the bucket. We get to the top of the bucket, and then we realize there's more.
There's a bigger bucket.
So yeah, I wanted to share that because it was just another experience for me that I hope others will have some courage to try out and ski down that double black diamond.
That's right. And yeah. I think with the speaking too, you really nailed something important. When we're speaking, it's not about us. Maybe for some there are. But it's really, how am I going to help the people who are listening? You know, how am I, because there's at least one person that needs to hear what we have to say. I mean, there just always is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the most interesting people are the most interested people, right? And the gateway to curiosity is questions. So if you really want to be engaging and interesting, engage in the interests of others.
Of others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've loved this. And I think if anybody's out there and they're listening and they have that fear about public speaking or any kind of fear, I think really, you know, taking what we've talked about here, knowing that you're not alone. Yeah. And just, I think about how grateful I am to my mom, you know, and it's, she passed in 2008, but I still think about it, you know, when I find myself up against a challenge, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. I still hear her voice saying, maybe not yet. You know what I mean? And that's legacy right there to me.
Totally. Totally.
You know, it lives on.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Absolutely.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for coming back and for, you know, participating in this. And I just appreciate it. And again, if they want to reach out to you, what's the best way?
The best way right now is through LinkedIn. I'm the most active and engaged there. And hopefully by the time this goes out into the world, my new website will be up. So
yay.
Shed Inspires, S-H-E-D, inspires.com.
Nice.
Is the new link for the website as well.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
Well, this has been a treat. Thanks for the invitation back. Thanks for the courage to share. And I'll say as well, I mean, leaders are the ones who feel the fear and do it anyway, because they're connected to something bigger than themselves, that it's more important. Something is more important than their fear. You know, there's that term fearless leader. Never met one.
No.
So just know that if you feel fear, it's because you're human.
I love that. That is perfect. I absolutely love a conversation that goes like that, where we just have an idea for a topic and then we let the conversation emerge. So here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, when you see a limit for yourself, you have some options. You have the option of confronting it, you have the option of ignoring it, or you have the option of rationalizing it away somehow. Now, I'm one of those people, I tend to not like speaking in absolutes, like we should never or we should always. But as I look back at my own experience and the experiences of those that I've coached and interviewed, I'm having trouble coming up with an example of when confronting our limitation wasn't a good idea. I know that for me, and it sounds like Stephen as well, confronting my limitation led to breakthroughs that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. Insight number two. I loved Stephen's formula when he shared that in the Marines, you have to have affection for those that you lead. And he said that to him, affection is seeing genius, worth, and potential in others. And I think that's really powerful when we think about all the different ways and all the different roles where we are leaders and just how powerful that is. Because to his point, if we have a negative view of someone, how can we possibly show up as a good leader for them? And finally, insight number three, it really resonated a lot for me when Stephen said that it was so liberating when he stuttered over his own last name, because that was one of his greatest fears. And it happened. And nothing bad happened as a result. I mean, that right there is the power of facing our fear, right? When we face the fear, the biggest thing that we're afraid of, and we do it, and nothing bad happens. I loved that. So I hope that you had your own takeaways from this and other episodes, and that those little insights are adding up and helping you thrive no matter what. That is why I started this podcast, and that is why I continue it. If they are adding up and helping you thrive no matter what, I hope that you'll share this episode with a friend or a colleague, as that helps us to help more people. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in and for listening. And I hope that you have an absolute fabulous week.